America. Today we have an excellent program for you. We will go over the nature and future of this show, the Orlando shooting, and later, the recently declassified CIA documents. All this and more coming up.
Direction, insight, spin. Welcome to the compass.
So the future of this program. So my name is Lucas Romanski, and I am the host of Mark My Words, this little internet show devoted to the working class, the liberation of people, and the future of America. So each episode we'll discuss some different issues in politics and economics, perhaps a bit of philosophy, and how they relate to worker struggles, the future of this country, etc. So a little bit about myself. I am a political activist, a socialist, a Marxist, and I feel that the media in our modern world does not represent the international interests of the working class. And for that reason, I felt that it was my duty as an American citizen to voice my perspectives and bring about change as far as I can in doing this little radio show. Furthermore, the show will be divided into segments. So right now we have only two segments, but perhaps we will have more. The first segment is going to be general news, updates, information, etc., which I gather from a variety of sources. Afterwards, I have a special section devoted to the shining beacon of the future of America. Specifically, I'm going to call this section That Ray of Light. It's the signal in the news that there is hope, that tomorrow will be better than today. I also want to mention in this introductory portion that I also have another program. It's called Democracy Radio, and I do that with WDOT Port Washington. It is the, as it calls itself, the Sound of Schreiber, which is our local Port Washington high school, which I attend. And that is where I found my interest in radio and broadcast. And I felt that over the summer at least, I should continue and further my goals and hopefully entertain somebody in the process. So our first issue, the shooting in Orlando. Is it Islam or is it something else? The people in the news and the politicians are attributing the shooting in Orlando to radical Islam. And I'm not sure that that is a fair assessment. There are many, many factors that I think we can attribute to the psyche of the killer. I've gathered a list of a few. His friends and family who attend the mosque with him don't describe him as particularly religious. That's number one. Number two is the FBI officials say that there were few signs, despite the two interviews, that he was, to use the language of the day, self-radicalized. Number three. However, he was particularly confused in terms of his political affiliations. He voiced support not only for ISIS, but also for Jabhat al-Nusra and Hezbollah, which are in ideological conflict and military conflict with each other. Just to go on, he was likely homosexual or bisexual, and he had attended the Pulse nightclub, which is the name of the gay nightclub, several times before. A little bit more about him. He was born in the United States and worked as a guard at a juvenile detention center for G4S, an international private security contractor, and he idolized the NYPD. So what does this really tell us? These are signs of an American obsession with violence and hate, not the aims or goals of radical Islam. This is typical of U.S. centrism, this idea that the United States and its supposed quote-unquote moral values are those the correct truths with a capital T about the world, that our perspective, our truth claims about the world, even though they are just truth claims, are correct by some universal standard, and therefore everybody else's truth claims are all wrong. I think it's clear that whether he was devoted to some extent to radical Islam or not at all, that there are other deeper psychological issues going on, and these need to be addressed too, and these most certainly have something to do with American society. So now I want to move on to the issue of the CIA declassifications. So, I have here in front of me, actually, the declassified document. So, this document was written, it looks like on the document, it's dated to December 2004, and it details explicitly the methods of U.S. torture. So first of all, these documents come to us via the American Civil Liberties Union, who filed a lawsuit against the agency. Now, the CIA there and therefore has released these documents, and I'd like to share with you some of their contents. So, there are all sorts of torture methods and whatnot detailed in these documents, so-called medical methods, so how doctors should treat the so-called terrorists or terror suspects, how they should be treated by the people who have them in custody, etc. But if you scroll down here to a certain part of the document, as I'm doing now, you'll find something very interesting. The subject is headed interrogation. And now I'm going to read to you directly from the document. Quote, captured terrorists turned over to the CIA for interrogation may be subjected to a wide range of legally sanctioned techniques, all of which are also used on U.S. military personnel and SERE training programs. These are designed to psychologically dislocate, that's in quotes, the detainee, maximize his feeling of vulnerability and helplessness, and reduce or eliminate his will to resist our efforts to obtain critical intelligence. Next paragraph. Sanctioned interrogation techniques must be specifically approved in advance by the director, CTC, in the case of each individual case. They include an approximately ascending order of intensity. So before I read that, I want to mention, I'm very happy at least to hear that these methods need to be approved case by case. That at least comes as a relief. But I think the overwhelming reality of these different torture methods, which is what they are, despite what they may or may not be called by the media, are pretty scary. I'm going to read down the entire list for you. Shaving, stripping, hooding, isolation, white noise or loud music, continuous light or darkness, uncomfortably cool environment, dietary manipulation, shackling in upright, sitting, or horizontal position, sleep deprivation, attention grasp, facial hold, insult, parentheses, facial slap, abdominal slap, sleep deprivation over 48 hours, water dosing and tossing, stress positions, on knees, body slanted forward or backward, leaning with forehead on wall, leaning on fingertips against wall. Next is walling, cramped confinement, confinement in boxes, or waterboard. It's unbelievable how contradictory American life is. We're taught in school that the saying, sticks and stones will break my bones, but words will never hurt me, is false. We're told that people's perception of what's going on or how they feel about something is incredibly important, just as important as the physical reality. These forms of torture, although will probably not damage the physical body, will cause mental trauma to the individual. But aside from any sort of morality, because I made the point earlier that morality is relative, and that just as I don't support American morality as a particular true morality, I don't support other moralities as particularly true moralities either. And I think this is once again the case that cruel methods can be used from our side, the American side, because we have some type of moral justification or we have the right cause. Whereas if they use these methods or more harsh methods as are typically used, they are somehow the bad guys. When in the reality, torture is torture. Now the interesting thing that I find most important in this whole mess is this, right? Forget about the morality or the perceived morality or any of that. I don't think torture is an effective way of gaining intelligence. It's just not a good strategy. And I have evidence here to back me up. So this is the PBS NewsHour that I'm about to play for you. This is David Iglesias speaking to Judy Woodruff.
Iglesias, does it work? And did it work in this case of Osama bin Laden?
Referring to torture.
No, it doesn't work. The problem with EITs, which is the euphemism for torture, is it doesn't work. You always want to get a voluntary statement with reliable information. And in every case that the Senate committee looked at, the actual evidence used came from non-abusive interrogation tactics. So as a former war crimes prosecutor, I can tell you it's radioactive. And more importantly, from a real politic point of view, it just doesn't work.
So it just doesn't work. But I want to play for you even more. All right. So now I'm skipping ahead in the interview to play for you another what I think is a very interesting segment from David here. So let's play this.
To the justification that people have been using, that because another attack was imminent, we had to resort to this. But if you look at the majority report, you look at the interrogation of Abu Zubaydah, he actually gave us the name of Mukhtar, who is Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. And that was done through the traditional law enforcement model of rapport-based interrogation. It wasn't used, it wasn't derived from abusive interrogation techniques. So I respectfully dissent from that.
Right, and he gave us—
And to go on, he goes on to say—
Iglesias, is it possible that enhanced interrogation, to use the term of art, is something that is useful to elicit information, glean information from people who are deeply committed to not cooperating?
No, it's a ruse. The term enhanced interrogation technique is a ruse. You always want to get accurate information. You want actionable intelligence, and you do that by getting a voluntary statement. Look, I can get somebody to admit to being the second shooter in the JFK shooting if I use the right techniques, but that's a worthless confession. We want something that's usable in court and usable to prevent future attacks. And the position of the majority, which I agree with, is by using traditional rapport-based interrogations.
Let me ask you that.
And let's even move forward. So the question that I think we need to address then is, how do we attain information? And I think he addresses this issue perfectly.
Traditional use of FBI techniques, which is the gold standard. You sit them down, you make them comfortable, you establish rapport, and then they will give you information. It's when you resort to torture or abusive interrogation, that's when you start getting information that typically is—
So I think to sum up, what the point is being made here, the point that is being articulated is that when you use, as they call them, enhanced interrogation methods, right, you risk losing validity of the information. Because, as he points out, you know, if you torture somebody long enough, they'll admit to anything. They'll give you whatever information you want to get the pain off, for the torture to end. And so these methods are really very ineffective as ways of, as methods of interrogation and gaining information. The next issue that we need to cover is the sit-in of the House of Representatives by the Democrats in favor of increased gun control. So they demanded two critical pieces of legislation. Number one, the expansion of background checks. And number two, they wanted legislation that ensured that anybody who was on the no-fly list cannot buy a gun. So first of all, I find this legislation absolutely horrifying, especially the piece about the no-fly list. Now, for those of you who are listening and aren't very familiar with my perspectives, you might say, I'm surprised he doesn't support the gun control. You know, he's a left-wing guy. Doesn't the left support gun control? Yes and no. Okay, the Democrats support gun control, but not necessarily the real, the true left, especially the radical left. So with regards to the no-fly list, this is directly against some of the most positive principles that went into the founding of our nation. One of the grievances pointed out in the Declaration of Independence was that under British control, there was no trial by jury. Trial by jury, therefore, is an essential part of American life. And here, with the no-fly list, there is no trial by jury. There is no democratic decision-making. There is just the government suspects that you have a problem, you might be a terrorist or whatever, and they just decide that you can't buy a gun. It's the government now being able to make laws. It's the government now being able to determine, to be the judge in matters of legality. So it's not a court, it's just bureaucrats in the government, in the federal government. But I do support gun regulation. I think we need to regulate the property itself, the actual gun. As a socialist, I support the regulation of private property. Of course, I support the worker control of the means of production, etc. But in our capitalist environment, regulating the natural caprices that private property calls is a positive thing that the government can do in people's lives. Guns is no exception. We can regulate magazine size, cartridge size, clip size. We can regulate silencers. We should regulate what kinds of guns can be sold. Those are common sense gun regulations, regulations on property that make sense to implement. Nothing to do with the shooting in Orlando, but they're just sensical things to put into place. These intrusions on our civil liberties are simply unnecessary. And for the last bit, that heartwarming story of the day, that ray of light, I want to speak a bit about worker co-ops. There was a study published a few weeks ago called What Do We Really Know About Worker Co-ops? And I want to give you a list of the four primary things that were found. One, worker co-ops retain larger shares of profits in the business. What does that really mean? It means that rather than having greedy capitalists at the top who suck up the profits and don't leave much to reinvest, worker co-ops, who don't have a capitalist sucking on the surplus labor of workers, it just has workers making democratic decisions, the profits are overwhelmingly reinvested to grow the business. Number two, worker co-ops are typically larger than conventional businesses and not necessarily less capital intensive. So I think the first part is self-explanatory. They're bigger industries, more employees, more stuff. And that's continued in the next bit, more capital intensive. It means that there is more capital flowing through the business. Number three, they survive at least as long as other businesses and have more stable employment. So what that means is that they're better for communities because it means that it provides job availability. It has steady employment, and that makes sense because would you lay off your own coworker? Probably not. Probably not. So the worker co-op system is better at providing jobs for people. And number four, worker co-ops are more productive and efficient, and they operate better and smarter than conventional businesses. This, friends, I think is the most important point, that worker cooperatives operate and produce more than the conventional business. So the stresses of labor under the business hurt the production process. Furthermore, they operate better and smarter. They organize the production in a more efficient way to produce more and to then have more profit to reinvest. And I think, friends, that this is the only future that America has. Businesses are leaving this country because it's more profitable to produce elsewhere. That's a fact. No tariff, no new public policy or trade agreement will change that. That is a reality dating back to the late 1970s, and it will continue on into our future. The less a capitalist can pay a worker, the better for the capitalist. And if we lower wages in America, then no one will be able to buy anything. And then business will fail and there will be no jobs. No matter how you organize it, the workers lose. If it's more profitable to produce elsewhere, they will produce elsewhere. If it is not more profitable to produce elsewhere, because we have no labor laws, we have no environmental regulations at all, which is what I think there are many politicians out there in this country who would support this policy, then workers will not have any money to make purchases, and businesses will die. Businesses rely on this odd relationship right now to keep them afloat, to keep capital in power. They produce things in other countries and then sell them back to us. Here in the United States, where wages are higher and working people have more money to spend on presents or on consumer goods for themselves or others. This is a system that cannot go on for much longer. Which hopefully, if that is the case, will bring an end to capitalism. Production can be taken over by workers. I think that, although it might be a tough reality, is a ray of hope. It is a ray of hope that it seems like somewhere in the distance, there has to be an end. It cannot survive. It will not survive. And hopefully, that next society, that future society, that new organization of production will meet human needs, will produce for the good of the whole, the good of the community, and not just the good of capitalists, of the owners of the world. In that society, we will have concern for our environment because the world and the fruits of the world belong to us all. And we all lose when Miami is underwater or New York City is being flooded. When the people of the world are in struggle or in hardship, that will hurt everybody. Because there is no capital. There is no capitalist mindset. There's no mindset that all I have to do is what's good for me. We have to do what is positive for society. And that future world, I think, can and will come about. Mark my words, America. The fight will continue.